Good afternoon, all. If I could, there's such excitement in the room, people can't stop networking. So hopefully people will come to order and they'll quietly sit down in just a moment. There we go. Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the CECAM annual members meeting. It's my privilege as chair. I'm David Astley. I'm chair of the board and also chair of the Council of Governors, whose role is to hold the board, the non-executives on the board, such as me, as well as appointers. Their role is to make sure that we're held to account and that we discharge our duties appropriately on behalf of the public to ensure that CECAM is a well-run organisation. Today we're going to hear an opportunity for us all, members of the public in particular, to hear a little bit about our work, and there'll be a number of annual reports that we need to present at the annual members' meeting. So it's an important event, and important event we're also in these very busy times for the NHS and for CECAM. We just get an opportunity collectively just to stop the clock for a moment and just truly to reflect on the sterling work of all of our staff, whether they work in frontline duties or in the corporate departments, just to stop the clock and just reflect on what's been a particularly challenging year for the National Health Service, but particularly for CECAM. And this is the first time, I think, in probably 3 years, I guess it must be nearly 3 years, where we've actually met in public, in person, as a body for the annual members' meeting. We've had to rely on Teams, and the whole organisation has been run remotely. And I have to say, it's very efficient, and saves travelling time. When it comes to actually understanding the organisation, understanding the people in it, it's extremely difficult to do that. So I welcome the fact we're now back together. We've got a question and answer session as well to come. We really can have a collective understanding of where we currently stand as an organisation. So in terms of just some, if I can also welcome on a guest to the meeting, we have a representative here of patients, of our local health community, of the integrated care boards, and reflecting the sort of increasingly the partnership working that we at CECAM embrace, but also we're part of a wider National Health Service, and more in particular, one of the pleasing things that have happened in recent years is the collaboration there has been in all of our three counties or three and a half counties that we serve, or the extremely close relationship we now have with not just with local government but also with the wider health service. So that is something which I think is something to be celebrated and increasingly will reflect going forward in our work. In terms of just some housekeeping for today, I hope what you've found where the various washrooms are at the back of the room. There's ample fire exits, and as far as I'm aware, there's no fire alarm test this afternoon. So if you hear the fire alarm, please depart in an orderly manner through the appropriate exits. The meeting is also being screened on YouTube. So that's great. That increases the public accountability and people can watch us. But there are microphones around, so please direct any comments to the chair. The microphones are sensitive. And if you wish to be careful, because you might be appearing on YouTube. So be careful how you also present as well, because you never quite know who's watching. But hopefully they're watching because they're interested in CECAM. So that's the sort of the background to today's meeting, my role. And we've got an opportunity now just to watch a short film, subject to technical challenges, which will just, again, highlight the excellent work of our organisation and the work that we do on behalf of patients. And the video is now finally gone, okay? It was working 1 minute before the meeting, so we now move on. Real-time decision making. So we'll now move to the next stage of the meeting, which is for me to ask Dr. Fiona Moore to lead a review of the year and present the Chief Executive's report. Because although we now have a new Chief Executive in Siobhan, we are most grateful of Fiona on a number of occasions in the past to step forward to be the interim Chief Executive. And it's only appropriate that the Fiona presents this report reflecting on the work of the last year. So Fiona.
Thank you very much indeed, Chair. I think when we talk about looking back, the bit about acting chief executives, I just didn't stand back quickly enough. I'm going to talk a little bit about the challenges and successes of the last year. So I think it would be fair to say that it was a year of continuing challenge, dominated very much by COVID. So the early part of the year saw us working with the Delta variant and the pressures that that put on the service, particularly in the Kent area, and the wave that we saw sweeping across SECAM. And then we continued to vaccinate our staff. We worked very hard to ensure that all our staff were able to work agilely where that was possible. And as the year went on, self-isolation was replaced by testing. Going in later into the year, we saw the rise of the Omicron variant, which was considerably more infective than the Delta variant, but fortunately was not as severe in terms of the numbers of patients landing up in ITU and dying as a result of infection. We launched our in-house booster vaccination programme, and we also saw towards the end of the financial year the CQC, who had been restricted in their activities over the previous 2 years, come out fighting and looking for improvements in the health service. Throughout the year, we saw significant pressures right across the service in 111, in EOC and on the road, in the light of having quite a number of our staff off sick and the pressures that were put on our staff by the continuing demands of going to patients who had often waited for much longer than we had hoped that they would. We had some supply chain issues, particularly early in the year, but by and large, I think we managed really well in terms of ensuring that our staff stayed safe in terms of having the adequate PPE available to them. Some really positive developments in our senior team. We saw the appointment of David Luis Gerada, who joined us in September last year, and then Rob Nichols, our Director of Quality and Nursing, who joined in February. Rob came about the same time as the CQC. I haven't actually asked him whether, in retrospect, if he'd known what was coming, he would have accepted the job. And I was extremely honoured to be awarded the Queen's Ambulance Medal in the Queen's Birthday Honours last year, which led to a wonderful celebration at Windsor Castle. So CQC came in February and March and inspected both from a well-led perspective and also our EOC and 111. That was initially part of a system inspection in Kent and Medway, but because we have an EOC and 111 in Kent, they also had the opportunity to look at our control rooms across the patch. So clearly my look back doesn't include the full CQC report, because that was only published in this financial year. But we had, of course, the initial feedback from the CQC and the draft report for factual accuracy checking. So although we couldn't share with our staff the full report, we had a pretty good idea of what was in it. And the initial feedback, which historically is generally a little bit more positive than what comes out in the full report, was really very concerning. From a well-led perspective, the CQC highlighted that there was a disconnect between senior management and the rest of the trust. They weren't able to see the golden thread of quality running right through the organisation and all aspects of what we do. And they found concerns about the culture of the organisation, about bullying, harassment and sexualised behaviour. However, they did highlight that we worked well with system partners. And that, I think, is a hallmark of a good organisation, because it means it's outward facing. And we did work very closely with our partners, particularly throughout COVID, and I think supported them really well. They felt that we had mounted a good response to the demands that placed on the service by COVID. I think actually that's an underestimate. I think we produced a really good response to COVID. I think that you know, were we to do it all again, would we do some things differently? Yes, but I think our priority was to try and keep our staff safe and our patients safe. And generally, we succeeded in that. The report also highlighted the work that David, my colleague on my left, had done because of the improvements that he'd made around data and also the overall impact that he'd had on the trust. As far as EOC and 111, they recognised that we were seeing much greater demand than we were ever commissioned to provide for. They highlighted the benefit of dual trained staff, and that was something that we had noted right throughout the pandemic, the ability to flex between call handling, between 111 and EOC to smooth out the peaks and troughs of demand. Well, there weren't many troughs actually, the peaks in demand. And they identified the examples of multidisciplinary working, and we saw that very much in the NHS 111 CAS. They did raise concerns about how we were able to demonstrate keeping patients in the stack. So the patients whose calls we had received, but we did not have the physical resources to respond to, how we were able to keep those patients safe while they were waiting. And they also highlighted concerns, as our staff do, about the significant number of calls that should not be getting an ambulance response. But they were very complimentary about the way in which our staff managed calls according to NHS pathways. They felt that there were good support mechanisms in place for staff and that we were using data in an effective way to predict and manage the surges in demand. Some other aspects to highlight. We initiated our BAME mentoring programme in August last year. We set up in our new clinical education department at Haywards Heath a simulation suite, which makes it much more effective when we come to train both existing and new staff in various techniques. We introduced the mental health first aid training, and that's something that's continued throughout this year. It's a two-day course and has been really well received by our staff. We initiated the level six course with the University of Cumbria, so that we now have we are now about to enter cohort five of that programme. We introduced, along with the stroke service in Kent and Medway, the use of telemedicine with stroke. That's been extremely effective and is now being rolled out across the rest of the three counties. We did a research programme in conjunction with the London Ambulance Service, and that programme is being highlighted for a potential award in the HSJ awards. Our critical care paramedics introduced treatment for patients with acute behavioural disturbance. That's a condition which has a significant mortality rate, and it's one that we are generally quite good at picking up in the control room, but until now had not really any effective way of clinically managing these patients when they were in extremis. And those of you who've been around a long time will remember Penthrox, the green whistle, the medication which almost was the hallmark of the problems that we had with the CQC when they came in 2016. We have now reintroduced Penthrox, and it is very popular with many members of staff, a bit like Marmite for some others, but a very effective analgesic and, interestingly, has much less impact on climate change than Entonox. Charlotte Spears is a technician in Kent who responded while off duty to a little boy who'd had a collapse and led to a successful resuscitation. And that was recognised by the Duke of Cambridge, who came to visit her on 999 day last year. And then everybody will be aware of the very sad death of Alice Clark, who died in a road traffic accident while responding to a Category 1 call in January at the beginning of this year. We had real problems in delivering our award ceremony during COVID because we couldn't do it face-to-face. And Janine and the comms team did a fantastic job in delivering online award ceremonies. The Queen awarded the whole of the NHS the George Cross in July last year. Sadly, that doesn't mean that you can put GC after your name. But it was a huge honour and really recognised the efforts of the whole of the NHS through the pandemic. And in CCAM, we developed and gave to all our staff the CCAM COVID coin, which again was really well received because, quite honestly, it looked a lot better than some of the coins that the other ambulance services produced. and staff felt that it was a worthy recognition of their efforts. Our wellbeing volunteers have been really positively received across the Trust, both by staff in our contact centres and staff on the roads. It's great when one of these vehicles rocks up when you're halfway through a shift and you could do with a hot drink and some chocolate, particularly the chocolate. We have automated ways in which to undertake our driver checks so that we don't have staff with out-of-date driving licences. And Dave Monk, who is here today, sitting at the back in front of the body-worn cameras, was appointed as our violence reduction support officer. And that's something which I think is very welcome to staff, because although violence against ambulance staff is relatively uncommon, we do get a fair bit of verbal abuse and are not always treated in a way which is appropriate to an emergency service trying to save lives and look after people. And then our new Make Ready Centres. We've been rolling out Make Ready Centres now for some considerable time. The most recent additions to the centres are Medway, which started the build in September 2021, and Banstead, which was completed and went live in July of this year. The Banstead facility is a real state-of-the-art station for ambulance crews and our Make Ready operatives to have a really high quality of delivery of ambulances, and the potential for doing high-quality training at that site. So Banstead, if you've not seen it, is really worthwhile either going to or looking at the virtual tour. And Medway is well on its way to being opened early in 2023. We've seen some other clinical improvements. The iPad that is absolutely fundamental to our electronic patient care record. We rolled out new iPads to replace the somewhat elderly ones to 3,000 members of staff. You've had the opportunity to look at the body-worn cameras, and if you haven't already seen them, please go and talk to Amjad and his team down there, because they've been very positively received by a significant number of our staff. Initially rolled out to those OUs which were most at risk of staff being subject to violence. With the new Make Ready Centres and progressively across the existing ones, we've rolled out new audiovisual equipment. And we also have the new primary response bag, which I believe is was coming here to be... I haven't actually seen it anywhere. We got the primary response bag? It's at the back. So please go and have a look at this. This has been a very cooperative piece of work, listening to staff and trying to make sure that we got the best piece of kit to carry the equipment that staff need to take into jobs with them, and to make sure that it's ergonomically as good as it can be. So very positively received by staff, and now at the point of being rolled out across the service. And these are the guys that I'm hoping to spend a bit more time with. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Fiona. Fiona, I know you've been very clear that you don't want any fuss made and you want to slip away quietly. We'll arrange that for you. You can slip away quietly. But before you do, can I publicly say thank you for your service to the NHS, to CCAM, and particularly on behalf of colleagues in the room, particularly our clinical colleagues who work closely with you, those in corporate departments. Just say a warm thank you on behalf of all the council of governors would want me to express that in public as well. So thank you indeed for what you've done, and continue to do for the next 6 months till you finally do retire. And when we were looking for someone to act up, I'm just so glad you stayed still for long enough for me to find you. So thank you, and thank you for that return. So this is our annual meeting, and you know, important part of the procedure is for the report, the annual report and accounts, to be presented to the governors and to our members. So Philip Astle, the Associate Director of Finance, is going to do that just now. So Philip, over to you.
Good afternoon. I'm Phil Astle, Associate Director of Finance, and my role is to present the the look back on the annual report and accounts for last year, with the main emphasis on the accounts for last year. So these are the areas I want to cover today. Start off by setting the scene, present the financial headlines for the year 21-22, talk about the income and expenditure in the year and the balance sheet at the end of the year, also known as statement of financial position, and then talk a bit about the investments that we made last year, capital investments. And then finally to ask the governors and the members to receive the accounts. So it was another extraordinary year, second year of the pandemic effectively, and the second year in which we operated under these rather extraordinary financial arrangements. We had we moved to a block contract for our emergency services. But then we also had a significant amount of non-recurrent funding for to meet our costs of COVID, and that was used to largely to backfill for COVID absences, which, as I'm sure you're aware, were significant. Stewardship of the and governance of the trust finances remained strong. The auditors gave a clean report on our financial statements for the year. And the intention moving forward is to further strengthen our financial governance in order to deliver a sustainable future for the organisation. And the other important aspect to mention is that we continue to provide that we're able to invest in providing the equipment for patients, staff, and volunteers. And also the infrastructure and the running costs to enable us to deliver the service efficiently and at high quality for the benefit of both our staff and our patients. So financial headlines, some of which is obscured, but we reported a deficit in our final accounts of 4.9 million. There were two exceptional items. Within that, one was to do with a change in the valuation of our assets, and the other was a gain on asset disposals. As we've been investing in make-ready centres, we've been able to sell off some of the old ambulance stations, and that's produced gains in some instances. Excluding those items, the deficit that we delivered for the year was 7.6 million. That was 2 million better than we'd planned for the year, and so 2 million better than we'd effectively promised the system we would deliver, which is obviously good news, but clearly we need to move from deficit to surplus moving forward in order to be able to deliver those investment plans I mentioned. There were quite a large number of non-recurrent items in the year. I mentioned COVID, but there were other significant elements of non-recurrent funding and non-recurrent costs that went against that. But in net terms, that enabled us to produce the improved position. We ended the year with a cash balance of 62.6 million. I'll say a little more about that in a second. We delivered efficiency improvements of 4.7 million, which is obviously a significant achievement, although we only delivered 27.6% of those schemes recurrently. So we need to in order to become sustainable as an organisation, we need to be delivering efficiency improvements on a recurrent basis. And finally, for this slide, the spend on infrastructure in the year, that's ambulances, IT and an estate, was 25.5 million. And that's 31% above how much we spent the previous year. Slide here just shows graphically our income and expenditure for last year. So you can see the bars on the left show our income, which increased significantly over the previous year. A large part of that was to do with the non-recurrent funding that I mentioned. And then we our costs against that, nearly 300 million, which again was significantly higher than the previous year. The net impact of that was a gross surplus. EBITDA, for those of you who are familiar with the financial terminology used in company statements, was 7.3 million against 11.6 million surplus the previous year. Then we had financing costs, which are quite significant. That includes depreciation as well as interest on leases and so on. And that increased to 14.9 million in the year. Our normalised deficit after taking those into account was 7.6 million, as I mentioned, and that compared to a figure of 0.5 the year before. And then we had these other two exceptional items, which I've already mentioned, to arrive at the reported position. So represented in a simple graphical way, our income for the year, 306 million. As you can see, the vast majority, nearly three quarters, was our income for our 999 service, largely funded through a block contract. Second largest was 111, the purple box. That represents 8% of our total income. Then after that, the non-recurrent COVID funding, we had support from the integrated care system of 4%, and then other bits and pieces that, although small in percentage terms, still very significant contributors to what we do. Heart, I should mention, I've been told off for using acronyms, hazardous area response teams. That's the emergency preparedness teams for critical incidents, for those who don't know. And then expenditure, total expenditure, 313.7 million. In common with most NHS providers, more than two-thirds of our expenditure is on pay. In our case, nearly 70%, in fact. The two next main categories of expenditure are our estates and our fleet, 7% each. And then these are other sources. Purchased from non-healthcare bodies, non-NHS healthcare bodies, that's largely the private ambulance provision that we use to supplement our substantive staff to deliver us a 999 service. CNST, again, is Clinical Negligence Scheme for Trusts. That's a pooling arrangement that the NHS has for clinical negligence schemes, clinical negligence claims. And PDC is a dividend that we pay on the financing of our assets. The statement of financial position, more commonly known historically as balance sheet, you see that our fixed assets increased slightly to 68.8 million. Current assets increased quite a bit, 59.1. That's mostly to do with an increase in cash, which I'll come on to. And total liabilities increased as well to by a similar sort of scale. Net assets increased to 70 million from 66. The main reason for the cash figure is a bit of a sort of snapshot of what the cash holding was at the end of the year. We'd accrued a significant amount of expenditure for capital, where we'd received and were making use of the relevant assets, but we hadn't yet paid the bill, and that was paid in the new year. So the cash figure, although it looks healthy and it looks high, is probably artificially inflated because of that. Capital investments, we invested 18.3 million in the estate, and that's mainly around the two Make Ready centres that Fiona referred to, Banstead, which is complete, and Medway, which is ongoing. We spent 5.2 million in IT resilient solutions. We spent 0.4 on medical equipment, 800,000 on purchase of ambulances and various fleet engines. I should mention that we actually lease, for the most part, we lease ambulances rather than buy them. So the cost of procuring ambulances won't appear here. It's effectively a revenue cost, even though from 1st of April this year that will be accounted for on our balance sheet. But we do buy the equipment that sits on the ambulances, and that was 1.2 million in the year. So finally, I'd just like to ask the Council of Governors and the members to receive the accounts, an annual report for 2021-22. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip, and thank you for your work, but also that of the finance team as well in bringing together the accounts to be presented today. So I'm assuming that we can move to accept the financial reports and the financial accounts, and we'll move on to the next item, which is the presentation from the lead governor, Lee Westwood, who's going to give a report on behalf of the governors.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Council of Governors, on which I represent the interests of the people of East Sussex and Brighton and Hove, which is otherwise known as SECAM's Lower East constituency, I present my report for the 2020-21 period. This report will focus on how the Council, a group of 21 volunteers, including members of the public, staff and people from key partner organisations, has fulfilled its statutory duties over the past year. Our collective duties as a Council are twofold. Firstly, to represent the interests of our Foundation Trust members and the wider public, and secondly, to hold the non-executive directors to account for the performance of the board. We also have some very specific powers, and I'll outline where we have used those during the year a little later on. But first, I should start by reflecting on this year. COVID-19 has impacted so heavily on most people in some way, and of course the ambulance service has quite literally been on the front line, providing care throughout the year. As governors, we have tried to support the service as it acted to flex as needed to keep providing the best possible service to patients while balancing the safety of SECAM staff and volunteers. I'd like to thank everyone working at SECAM for their incredible efforts to date. The Council has been focused throughout the year on helping ensure that the Trust was doing its best to protect its staff and volunteers, while recognising that at times demand for its services was incredibly high. The Council adds its thanks to all the incredible volunteers who have and continue to support the Trust. The Governors have continued to observe board meetings and board committees, and this has provided the Council with the assurance that board scrutiny and oversight has continued despite the many challenges. At the time of writing, discussions are ongoing about how we maximise the benefits of enabling online access to future meetings, as well as reintroducing face-to-face meetings safely. Naturally, Foundation Trust membership engagement and recruitment, as well as external events, have had to be stopped over the past few years. We look forward to kicking these off again in earnest. Communication via our membership newsletter, Your Call, has continued, and our membership numbers remain strong despite the lack of physical presence of our governors out and about around the South East. It is fair to say that for the Council, as well as for the board, and Trust more widely, the focus has, of necessity, been squarely on responding effectively to the unprecedented challenges posed by the virus. However, the council has continued to seek improvements in other areas of the trust where reasonable during the year. We do this through questions submitted between formal meetings, as well as by holding the non-executive directors to account at our council meetings. Areas of focus for the council this year have included operational performance in 999 and 111, how well are we serving our patients? Assurance around items highlighted in the non-executive director committee reports, the work of the council's committees, the plans for the trust's improvement journey, the launch of the Community Falls Team Initiative, and reviewing the annual audit report via presentation from KPMG. The council has a rolling agenda of scrutiny items covering the remits of each of the board committees, and these have continued throughout the year. Governor questions to the non-executives between meetings have included the following topics, some of which are COVID-related, but not all. Safety of our colleagues on the front line and trials of the body-worn cameras. Seeking assurance on the provision of mental health support for colleagues. Process and recording public access defibrillator locations and maintaining them. Timely public communication on the present pressure the service is facing. Supporting the effective use of our community first responders to respond to calls. Recruitment and retention of colleagues. That pulse and staff survey outcomes will be acted on. Safety provisions for all staff in relation to the estate's programme and vehicles. Assurance on staff engagement with the Agile Working Programme. Hospital handover delays and the Trust's work with partners on this. And support from the Trust for Ukraine via decommissioned vehicles and medical supplies. In terms of statutory powers, the Council has made several non-executive director appointments and reappointments this year, and we are currently recruiting for another. Non-executive director remuneration has remained static. The Council appointed two new non-executive directors during the year, Elizabeth Sharp and Paul Brocklehurst, both recruited by the Nominations Committee of the Council, working in tandem with the BAME Recruitment Agency. The Council approved a second term of office for Michael Whitehouse. This year, though, the Council said a fond farewell to Terry Parking, Lucy Bloom and Laurie McMahon, who concluded their terms as non-executive directors at CCAM. On behalf of the Council, I would like to thank them for their diligent service. Council elections were held this year with a good turnout in nominations and votes. Thank you to all members who took part in this process. This year we will hold another election for seven governor positions, including one for operational staff governor. The call for nominations opens today. So if you can give energy and thought to helping us be the best that we can be for patients and staff, and are passionate about the NHS, please do consider standing in our Council of Governor elections. As a trust member, you can stand as a governor or vote for a governor to represent you. Finally, I must express again on behalf of my governor colleagues our admiration and respect for everyone working for or with CCAM and across the wider health and social care system during the past year. Governors must continue to hold the non-executive directors to account for the performance of the board in the interests of our members and the wider public, particularly doing this at times of additional pressure and stress. We do this with the utmost respect for the pressures everyone has been under and look forward to working together and meeting in person again in the coming year. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you for that report. And on behalf of my board colleagues, thank you for your diligence and your leadership of the Council of Governors and our developing working relationship. Thank you indeed for what you do and all of our governor colleagues as well. Now, to move on to the next item, Fiona presented the review of the last year. But it's only appropriate that we take this opportunity for our new chief executive, Siobhan, to look forward to some of the challenges that are facing CECAM and some of the positive action that will be taken to continue to develop the organisation. So, Siobhan.
Thank you, David. Hi, everybody. So before I start with the slides that may not work, I'll just fill, which I was going to do anyway, just let me know. So the first thing I was going to say is thank you to everybody at CECAM for making me feel so welcome. It's been 8 weeks, but it feels like 8 months, and I mean that in a good way. I've realised that a week at CECAM is like a month anywhere else. So much happens every day. So thank you for welcoming me into the organisation. And many of you know I've been out and about every week, multiple times a week. And there's some really consistent things that people have told me, which I was going to talk about before the slides, which I'll proceed to talk about, which is, you know, two-way meaningful engagement and communications that works for busy people in busy roles are probably the two things I've heard most consistently. So I hope those of you who work for CECAM are in the room have realised and recognised that as an exec team, we've really tried to make a difference in how we get some key messages out to you, but importantly, how we hear back from you. So the year ahead for me is going to be a departure from the style of communication we've all been subjected to through the pandemic years, which is very, very command and control, very nationally driven, very much about the transmission of information that we were required to act upon. And certainly the first 2 years of the pandemic, I recognise that sentiment. I think looking forward for us here for this year, it's about engagement in meaningful dialogue and a true spirit of co-production of the ways in which we collectively improve here at CECAM. So that was really my opening thoughts. The one thing that I think is going to be really important about this year, more than any other year, is how I and the executive team strike the balance between optimism and realism. And so what I mean by that is there are many reasons to be optimistic. There are many fantastic things happening in this organisation all day, every day. There are many, many system partners in health and social care systems and integrated care systems who want to work in partnership with us to do new things in new ways to improve outcomes for patients. So there are many reasons to be optimistic, and there are many reasons that we will be reminded of the realism of the health and social care system right now, which is still, frankly, I think, collectively reeling from the impact of the pandemic. People being more ill, struggling to access the care they need in the right place. A winter ahead of us that looks probably very different to the last 2 years, and we need to be open and honest that it will be tough. There will be respiratory illness. We have a cost of living crisis. And somehow we will need to roll our sleeves up and both deliver on our improvements, but deliver the day job at the same time. So I'll continue to remind us all that the reasons to be hopeful are the things that will give us the energy to keep going, and the year ahead will undoubtedly throw us, I think, some very different challenges. But one thing we know from the journey CECAM have been on and the pandemic years is that we know how to roll our sleeves up, pull together, and get stuff done, both for our people and our patients. So there's a slide deck now, which thank you very much. I shall move to. I'm just going to talk to the first three slides, and then I will hand over to David, who's going to go into a bit more detail. So that said, in terms of my framing about the year ahead, we do have a very clear improvement journey that has four pillars to it, which I'll come on to. And I don't want to labour too much on some of what Fiona's already covered about the year that's just gone by. But it is important for us to recognise that there are things that our people have told us and that the CQC have told us that we really need to focus on and we must improve. Sorry, let me just go back. So we heard from our people in the staff survey that CCAM doesn't feel like a great place to work. The lack of kind of vision and direction of travel was a bit of a problem, and also that the trust in senior leadership in particular was very low. And we also heard that there's a lack of quality thread throughout the organisation, that there were significant concerns over the culture, and that there was a disconnect between both the board and the senior leaders and the rest of the organisation. And so prior to me coming here, the teams have been working really hard on how do we absorb all of that information and create a journey, a direction, a travel, a vision, an ambition that makes people feel better about working here, and that somehow connects different layers of the organisation in a meaningful way. So, before I hand over to David, these are the four pillars that we've landed on, and I think they're really strong and powerful pillars, and I think they will pervade over a period of time. So for those governors that were in the Council of Governors and board meeting earlier, we spoke about some very, very immediate tasks that we're focusing on at board level for the next 6 to 8 weeks. What we've got here is a more kind of strategic view of a journey over time where we will, as I say, hear from our people, hear from our partners, and evolve the actions that we need to deliver under these four pillars. So quality improvement is probably a phrase that I've heard in the NHS for a number of years that's easy to say and difficult to do. Very, very difficult to do in my experience. In a geographically dispersed organisation, the complexity of staff out and about and in people's homes and in hospital EDs means that our approach to quality improvement needs to be really well considered for the context in which we work. So we already have a focus on quality and patient safety at different layers in the organisation. What we now need to do is create that golden thread and that systematic approach to different methodologies, different ways of doing things that mean we measure at the start what we're doing, we put some interventions and some changes in place, and we measure at the end and we prove that we have demonstrably improved experience, outcomes, efficiency, productivity, or whatever it may be. So quality improvement is a really great focus for us. We're just about to onboard next month at somebody who's got a high level of expertise in this area. And so I think we have leadership and energy that we've probably not had before to help us to make the right decisions. The next one is around responsive care. And it says delivering modern healthcare for patients. And I think what I've heard consistently, as well as engagement and two-way dialogue, is the model is kind of broken at the minute. It doesn't feel as though patients are getting the best from us because of the demands that are placed upon us that ordinarily would be shared across health and social care systems. So I'll come on to partnerships in a moment, but I think in delivering modern fit-for-purpose services, the one thing I'm fairly clear about and the team are fairly clear about is we can't do that alone. We can't internalise our own future in the context of complex systems that come together to create pathways of care across health and social care for patients. So being more responsive relies us to work in partnership, which is why we've got a new focus on what was our sustainability pillar, which I'll come on to. People and culture, I think, you know, we need to talk about the fact that people have described and the CQC have described the culture not being great here, and that people have reported that there's a culture of bullying, which Fiona mentioned earlier. So what I recognise is it's easy for me to say that's not acceptable and the rest of the board to say that's not acceptable, but we do have to follow that up with some actions. We have to be really clear about what we expect with regards to the values here. And that's one of the other things this year I think we really need to do more of is bring to life the trust values. There's a value around respect and compassion. And I think if we talked about it enough, we would be able to identify where behaviours are not as we would wish them to be and call them out in a way that says you come to work, you sign up to the CCAM values, you've got to work and live by them when, you, when you're here in the workplace. So I think for me, the people and the culture bit is obviously not a quick fix, but there are ways in which we can be more values driven and how we can support each other to speak up when things don't go well. So that one is complex, but will remain a big priority for us for some time. And then the last one around partnerships and sustainability. So this, what I really like about this focused pillar is probably a month ago, it was called financial sustainability. And then we started talking to some people about it and hearing people's views. And then it changed to sustainability more broadly because we want to be net zero carbon. We've got a green plan. Environmental sustainability is as important as financial sustainability. And then as recently as last week, the teams have been focusing again on actually, what does that mean for us? What does it mean for our future? And I think it's very, very powerful to have the word partnerships in there for all the reasons I described earlier around the need to deliver modern healthcare services for patients and for our people. There are some innovative ways of doing that we probably need to imagine and reimagine in different partnerships. So what's gone before probably won't be fit for the future. And I think we've got a great opportunity this year to start building some of those foundations that help us to have a more responsive and modern healthcare model through the lens of the partnership discussions that we'll be having. So I know there's a slot for questions and answers later, so I'll let that percolate with everybody. And then now I'll invite David to come into some of the more detail that sits behind this to give you an idea of what this next year does look like for us. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. It's David. I'm the planning director. And after spending 6 hours on Monday trying to get this presentation right, you almost give me a heart attack when you say it didn't work. So let's explore this a little bit more. People and culture is a key pillar of the improvement journey. One of the things we've been focused on is trying to distill. We could talk about a program. We could talk about a big project management. These are all the risks that we're facing, and this is what we're trying to deliver. But we've tried to boil it down to things that can be translated into an impact. How will CCAM be different as we deliver this improvement journey? And this is probably aspirational outcomes that we want to be able to say, by the end of this financial year, this is what we've been able to accomplish. And some of this will inevitably roll over next year, and some of these things we'll just want to keep there forever because it's part of the ethos of what we want to be doing as an organization. So one of the key things this year is recruiting and growing our CCAM family to be able to better support our patients. And once we get additional colleagues join us, make sure that they're well supported throughout their journey with us. Siobhan's already talked about our values and making sure that we live those every single day and we call it out when we're not living them and we have an absolute zero tolerance to poor behaviors. That is something that needs to start at board level, and we need to be looking at what we do at the board with the information that we receive, but it's also something that we need to encourage and train managers across the organization to be able to have those difficult discussions and challenge poor behaviors when we happen. And you don't need to be a manager to challenge poor behaviors. In fact, anybody should be able to challenge poor behaviors and make sure that we hold each other to account to live to our values. One of the big things that the CQC picked up on is the lack of an ability to hear that CCAM has. So this one is particularly important around making sure that the channels for raising concerns are very clear and transparent for everybody, making sure that our freedom to speak up functions, our different mechanisms for staff to raise concerns are there and are effective, and that people looking at concerns when they're raised act on them swiftly and we can take appropriate action where it's required. And finally, for this pillar, it's about changing how we listen and engage with everybody. And Siobhan's already alluded to this, and it's a theme that you will hear more and more about it. We are challenging ourselves on a weekly basis to improve how we communicate, how we engage. And I think there's more to come in this space because it's very, very important. And it's a key part of the experience that we give to our people. It's our understanding what is this organization about and where are we going. Our second pillar is around quality improvement. And it was in the title that we saw before, but essentially this is all about learning more about incidents when they happen. Mistakes happen. That's a core part of life. And what we need to do is be able to learn about those mistakes and make sure that we don't make them again. And that will improve patient care in the long term. Future-proofing our medicines management approach. That's something that, again, the CQC has picked up, and it's a core focus of this year. We have an active program looking at how we manage medicines in a different way, both from a technology and systems perspective, as well from an infrastructure perspective. And creating a better system for how we identify risks and share the action that we need to take in response to those risks at a trust-wide level. And you may be aware, our Datix system, for instance, migrated to clouds now already. So that transition's already started, but it will need to go alongside some changes in the processes that go around that system. Finally, listening more to what our patients are telling us and learning and doing changes based on what they tell us. This is all about improving patient experience. If we improve patient experience, we're inevitably going to be improving patient care at the same time. A third pillar, responsive care. And this is at the core of everything that we do, is about getting to patients in a responsive way. So one of the things that inevitably, as we have a service that is going to be challenged, and we know we don't have enough colleagues out on the road delivering patient care, and we know that we probably are challenged in our call centers being able to pick up the phone quick enough to respond to patients when they call us. So it's absolutely essential that we make sure that we can explain what are we doing to keep patients safe, regardless of how busy we are. So I'm pleased to say that we've talked about the patient mapping journey that the CQC picked up on, and we have a quality summit next week where I'm sure some of our colleagues in the room will be attending, and we will be looking at what are those risks across six key focal areas of the organization and making sure that those learnings are shared. And I'm pleased to say we will be having, I believe, quality summits every 6 months is the plan. So that is something we're introducing as part of responsive care. But as you can see, these pillars are very intertwined. Using on time seen effectively, on seen time effectively, to make sure that when we are with patients, we get the maximum value out of every single minute that we spend with patients. Safely enhancing the virtual response that we give to patients. And that means increasing the amount by which we do hear and treat. Every patient that we're able to refer to an alternative, more appropriate pathway means that a colleague on the road doesn't need to go to see a patient and then ultimately leave them home. And that in turn makes that colleague available to attend to a higher acuity call that could need a physical response more urgently. So this is a big thing that the team are working on this year, and that sits alongside developing smarter dispatch processes. And we've been working with an external expert to help us enhance our dispatch model and improve how we utilize everybody's time when you're on the road. The second to last thing is to make sure that we have the right resources at the right place at the right time. And that's about making sure that as we look at demand and where patients are calling us from and what time of the day, that we're making sure that colleagues are rostered for those times during the day to make sure we meet patient demand. And finally, ensuring that our fleet and our estates are fit for purpose. We've seen a number of make-ready centers that have been developed over the last couple of years, but we know that we have some significant challenges, and we all know what's happened at Chertsey in recent weeks, and we know we have still OUs such as Guildford, Dartford, and Paddockwood, which are significantly challenged because they don't have or have been a long time since they've had a development. So strengthening how we decide where that next investment is going to be very important. And also making sure that our fleet is absolutely fit for purpose and the right tool to work in for 12 hours a day, but also the right tool to be able to deliver clinical care to our patients. And finally, sustainability and partnerships is the fourth pillar for the year. And covering a little bit of what Siobhan has already talked about, this is absolutely about making sure that we utilize every single resource in the most effective way for the front line. Progressing our plans to deliver a net zero carbon footprint for our organization, and the Trust, in case you don't know, signed up in January this year to a target of 80% reduction of direct emissions by 2032. So it will be a huge effort to achieve that in an environment where we're burning diesel to get to patients, and we have such a big estate. We have 122 different bits of estate across the Southeast. So that's going to be significant, but we're working with the right experts to develop that plan, and then we'll see that plan through over the next 10 years. This one is going to be key, and Siobhan's already alluded to how important it is to work and be a strong system partner. None of this we will be able to deliver by ourselves. So making sure that we operate in the context of a wider NHS system is going to be fundamental in strengthening those relationships and making sure that we seek for help where we need it, because we won't be able to do everything by ourselves. And this last one is particularly important in my view. Developing a 5-year plan, it could be an 8-year plan, it could be a 3-year plan. It needs to be a longer term plan than saying, what are we going to do by the 31st of March? And when we talk about improvement and we look at these sort of images where we have people climbing a mountain, we may be tempted to think, well, we need to get through November and we need to appease CQC and then we need to get to the 31st of March and then everything will be better then. And that would absolutely be wrong. The reality of improvement is that it looks like this. It's a much longer journey and it has peaks and troughs, and we need to recognize that unless we set the vision for where we want to be, not just over the next 12 months, but over the next 24, 36, 48 months, we won't be able to make significant progress, because some of these things will take much longer than 12 months to change. And finally, Thomas Edison said, vision without execution is a hallucination. And that just really, I really like this quote. Every time I have a chance to put it in a presentation, I put it down. We can talk about this all day long, but unless we do something different tangibly, none of this is going to happen. And it's not going to happen only at a board level. You know, we can only get so far with some of these changes. A lot of it will need to come from people who do this day in, day out. So a core part of how we want to deliver this improvement journey is by making sure that everybody is a key player in it. And actually, as a matter of fact, we have a table at the back where you can go and tell us your ideas for improvement journey across each one of these four pillars after. So I do encourage you to go and speak to the team and have a discussion around what are your ideas for improvement, because what we want to make sure is that this is not an improvement journey that is driven by the top down. At the moment, we have some warning notices, and absolutely we need to focus on those. But the objective is that this is a bottom-up approach. Everybody in the organization has an ability to feed into improvement and share your thoughts and ideas. In the meantime, we've already talked about this. What are we doing to have an immediate impact? So we've been quite a lot of visits. So over 100 leadership visits have happened over the last 2.5 months. So it works about one a day where a member of the exec or a member of the board is going out and doing either an observation shift, a listening day, or speaking to colleagues. We are changing how we share information, and we've talked about that. You know, you've seen shorter videos coming from us in 2-minute snippets. We're not going to do as many webinars, and we've changed the e-bulletin, and there are more changes that we want to do, making sure that we modernize how we communicate and engage with everybody at CCAM. And finally, collecting ideas for improvement. You will have seen the improvement.journey at CCAM email. It's been out now for a couple of times, and we need to do more by way of creating the structures that will allow everybody anywhere at CCAM to provide ideas for improvement and for those to be taken into consideration and for everybody to get involved into improvement. And that is something that we don't have there yet. It's not a structure, it's not an infrastructure that we have established, but that's the intent over the coming weeks, is to build something that would allow us to make sure that everybody in the organization can feed into this improvement journey in a sustainable way. And finally, one of the things that the CQC told us was that there wasn't a strong enough clinical voice in the organization. So I'd love to hand over to Andy Collin to tell us more about the clinical advisory group. There you go.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name's Andy Collin. I'm one of the consultant paramedics. I'm delighted to be able to announce the launch of the clinical advisory group. But wait for my slides to come up. Common theme. I haven't got the talent to fill in the way that Siobhan did, so I'm going to just leave it an awkward silence. I will try and push on. So the clinical advisory group is a group that's been sort of in gestation and been as an idea for some years. And what we've been able to achieve in our terms of reference, is a group that recognises that we are an increasingly diverse, multi-professional group of senior clinical leaders who are in a great position to support the organisation in its improvement journey in all of the pillars that have been described today, to enhance the way we make decisions about the care we deliver and how we can enhance the experience for the people delivering that care. And essentially, on the basis of providing high quality, independent advice alongside with and on behalf of the key parts of the organisation, such as the senior management group, the executive group, and ultimately the board on behalf of our patients and population. I mentioned that the multi-professional aspect of this. So we have a group of leads from Allied Health, so predominantly paramedics, although we do have other Allied Health professionals in our organisation, nursing and midwifery, pharmacists, medicine, and others I've probably forgotten and will be chastised for later. But we wanted to come together to provide this function to solve some of those really knotty problems on behalf of the organisation that allows our senior decision makers and leadership function to have that independent recommendation that they can use to enhance their decision making. And we've broken it down into the areas that you can see here. So really getting to grips with how we respond to the CQC's challenge around visible clinical leadership. Changing our models of care, so turning the aspiration for virtual response and taking it from hear and treat into something that looks different for low acuity but perhaps more high complexity patients. Horizon scanning and using the evidence base that's out there and turning that into sustainable change that promotes that element of our improvement journey. And the rest, you can see, this is the shortest slot of the day, so I won't go on too far. The important principles of the group, as laid out in its terms of reference, is to promote the values of the organisation, so to make sure that we take pride and that we promote an environment where all of our colleagues can take pride in what we do every day, promoting that continuous improvement model, acting with integrity, with a compassion and respect, not just for our patients, but for our staff who are delivering care to our patients, and assuming responsibility. And we, as a senior group, and I'm delighted to represent the group as the chair of the CAG, we're delighted to take that responsibility on behalf of the organisation. Importantly, we want to be a listening group. We want to be very transparent, so our meeting cycle will be recorded. We'll be inviting observers, and we will make sure that the outputs of the group are well understood and accessible to everyone. So that is a very short, this was the shortest slot on the agenda, I'm pleased to say. So again, thanks again for inviting me to announce the launch of the Clinical Advisory Group as one of the important elements of our improvement journey. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. It might be the shortest slot, but I think it's actually one of the more important slots, quite frankly, because what it's announcing is a SECON change in SECAM, which Siobhan has highlighted, as the rest of the leadership and David in the presentation as well, that the voice of our clinicians matter. We are a multi-professional team now. We're not just about paramedics, how important as that is, now that's our largest profession. We have other colleagues as well. Together, we're a team. And the whole organisation really, particularly those in corporate departments, need to be geared up to support the clinical frontline to make sure that all you do either say within our clinical workforce, but more importantly, the clinicians to support our emergency operations centre. You know, we give a virtual support as well. That's so important in terms of we have that multi-professional input. So it really is important. I'm so delighted it's been launched. I know it'll thrive under your leadership, and I really would encourage those in our professional disciplines to really get involved, because your voice is wanted. We want to hear us. We want to hear it via the clinical advisory group that will actually influence the policy making in the organisation and make sure that clinically led is not just a slogan that's trotted out at meetings. It actually means something. So that to me is absolutely crucial. So thank you for what you're doing. And we're delighted. We'll look forward to the product of those deliberations in due course. Now, I think we're going to move on now to the question and answer session. So if I just declare a few minutes break, while those who are on the panel can take their place on the stage, and then I will then revert to my inner David Dimbleby and attempt to hold the panel to account on your behalf, because I'm sure there's a few questions that people want to ask in the sort of short time that we have available. But it's important we get some feedback. So this is not going to be a succession of talking heads. We want some feedback from the audience as well and some questions. So can I ask the panel, please, to those that aren't on the stage today, could you please join us? I think Lee, you're going to join. So we have a galaxy of CCAM talent here from various parts of the organisation.
Oh, there's no chair, I'll go.
We just need a... Do you want to bring one more chair up? Yeah, bring the chair up as well. And first of all, can I just ask the distinguished panel just to quickly introduce themselves, who exactly they are. So, sir, Dave, yours. Into the microphone, Dave.
I was going for yours. hello, I'm Dave Hawkins. I'm a critical care paramedic and an operating unit manager. I look after Guildford OU.
Good afternoon, I'm Emma Williams. I'm Executive Director of Operations.
Right, good afternoon. Welcome and thank you for taking part. Now, we were meant to have a galaxy of questions that people have put in the box so I could ask them. But so far, before the start of this, there was one question that was put in the box to ask. So we'll start with that. Then I'll invite members of the audience, if you wish to ask a question, that Lee and the colleagues will have a microphone. If you could say who you are, if you please keep your question relatively short so we can make sure the panel are held to account and give you some answers. And then we can then get to a sort of hopefully an interactive discussion. But Emma, you had the first question, which was relating to driver training for our volunteer colleagues.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. So I will read the question. Do CCAM have plans to deliver the driving course for emergency responders in a modular form as opposed to the 3-week course? So just to update people on what emergency responders are, we have a team of community first responders. We've got some people in red, so if you look immediately over there, you will see some of them. But we are doing a trial in two areas to create a team of emergency responders. They are CFRs, but with additional skills, and that they will respond in pairs on blue lights in specific identifiable vehicles. We're building on a trial that London has done, and really focusing on those hard to reach areas where we really struggle to get as quickly as we would like to some of those most critically unwell patients. Unfortunately, blue light driving courses are very structured for very clear legal reasons as much as anything else, and actually it's not something you can do in a modular way. You need to do it in a continuous format from start to completion. So that's what we've contracted the companies for. That is what we will be delivering. So unfortunately for emergency driving, it's the same for any emergency driving you do within CCAM. You do the totality of the course. You don't do sort of a week, a month for 5 months.
Thank you. And just those that asked that question, can I just come back just to see if there's any comments on that? So can we get a microphone? Lee, can the gentleman here have a... On the third row at the end? If you can kindly introduce yourself and please comment.
Thank you. My name is Julian Winks and I'm a first responder in Crowborough. Now, I know this scheme isn't available in our area, but I'd love to take part if it was. A 3-week course is an absolute showstopper. I can't do it. I run my own business. I cannot be out of my business for 3 weeks solid. I was also a part-time firefighter. Their driving is 2 1-week courses, 1 week to get your HGV, and 1 week blue light training. So it fails me why you need 3 weeks.
Emma, you have to comment?
And I'm more than happy to call in on, I know Ash is here, if Ash is still here, who's our head of clinical education. Blue light driving for fire service, is ambulance services, police services, they follow a slightly different format. This is the format that we follow as a national format. I appreciate for some people it will be a showstopper to doing this. But part of the evaluation is for us to do this. We're only doing it in two areas. That's what we've been funded for at this point. I know there's a lot of interest in it, but that is how the courses are run. Is Ash still here? Is he? No.
I think he's departed.
No, it's fine. It's not a problem. I just thought if he was here, because he'd probably be someone who could give you all the details. But fundamentally, blue light driving courses are delivered in a continuum, because that's the way it is done in order to complete it, and it's the way it's contracted at present.
Okay. I've driven a fire engine on blue lights. I had a week's training. So it works.
Well, so I'm actually going to reach over to Mr. Rist. Mark Rist, over there on the right-hand side, I work very closely from Kent Fire and Rescue. Mark, would you like to...
Mark's also one of our governors, so it's particularly... It's great you can comment, so
sure,
please, Mark.
Yeah. I'm the Director of Response and Resilience in Kent Fire and Rescue and have responsibility for all our training, including driver training, and we have exactly the same issue as Emma. The legislation has changed. It wouldn't be 2 one-week courses now. An extraction of our colleagues, whether they're full-time or part-time, is really, really difficult for us because we have to meet exactly the same legislation, and it's completely out of our hands.
Thank you, Mark. Well, so I think we're moving.
So much talent and skill that we'd like to do that.
Yeah, I think that just to conclude the item, I think what we've heard is it's a uniform approach in all emergency services. I think we've also heard from Emma that we will keep this under review. And what I'd like to do is celebrate the work of our volunteers, the fact we're now expanding the role. Because I've been here 4 years, and I think the early years, all I heard were consistent frustration from our volunteers regarding lack of initiative, the fact we weren't embracing them. Now I think, you know, I can detect some real progress here. Now, we're not saying we've fixed it yet, for sure, but I know from the operational side of the organisation, for Emma in particular, the leadership now, through Dave Wells and the team, there's a real commitment to make sure that our volunteer workforce is feeling more and more engaged in the work of CCAM within appropriate governance limitations. We have to recognise that. And we don't want to put our volunteers into situations that expose them to risk unnecessarily. So I think we're getting a good balance now. Yeah, question to the public.
Thank you. Sally Ann Hart, I'm Member of Parliament for Hastings and Rye.
Oh, Sally, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. So first, I'd just like to say thank you to CCAM for the amazing hard work and efforts they give to all my constituents. I think you do an amazing job. But there is a movement locally about response times, so I just wanted to probe that a bit further and to ask to what extent are the hospital handover delays having an impact on ambulance response times? And what needs to be done by CCAM, by its partners, and by government? And the second question, if I can, is that allowed?
Please, absolutely, yes.
Yes. The abuse and violence from some members of the public to the ambulance service, is it getting worse and is it documented? And what would you like to see happen on this?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Perhaps, Siobhan, who wants to take this first?
I'll perhaps take the first question. Whilst hospital handovers are a challenge, I think relative to other parts of the country, the CCAM footprint is doing really well. So I look at this multiple times a day because I get asked questions from acute trust chief execs and ICB leaders. I think what's good in Kent, Sussex and Surrey are the working relationships, both at executive and operational level. Over the course of recent days, the average handover on a 24-hour period has been 18 to 25 minutes. That's recent days, so I'm not for the crews in here saying hasn't felt like that over the last couple months. I'm aware it's been challenging through the summer. But what I hear from hospital chief executives is an absolute commitment to share risk where patient care is compromised, and what government and NHS England did very well, just as we were hitting the first heat wave this summer, was to ask hospitals to wait no longer, to allow ambulances to wait no longer than 30 minutes in the queue. When that letter went out, I think we all saw a demonstrable improvement in the length of time. So, of course, it's up and down. But relative to what happens in other parts of the southwest of England, the West Midlands, the delays are not prohibitive to us being able to deliver good care on a consistent basis. I'll caveat all of that by saying, of course, where there have been spikes in demand into the call centres and demand on the road, that becomes more challenging to get the crews back out again, and any delay has an impact. So the relativity of it for me is important, and we benchmark nationally pretty well on it. I think the relationships, the system working, the conversations at crew and ED level, operational leadership level and executive level are the way to continue to make sure that anything that's a particular challenge is work for you together. On the violence and aggression, I'll hand over to Emma.
Thank you. I'm actually just going to take 2 minutes just to ask Dave. Dave lives this and breathes this every day in Guildford. So just your experience of working on this.
So I've looked after Guildford for about a year now. And when I joined Guildford, I inherited responsibility for two hospitals where hospital handover delays were very significant. And I found that with a joint understanding of the risk, with speaking to the hospitals and understanding that patients in the community without anyone with them actually present quite a significant risk. Patients, whilst none of us want to care for patients in hospital corridors are probably slightly less at risk. And with our understandings of that and with some partnership working and management, we've actually managed to reduce our hospital handover delays quite significantly, to the point where over an hour handover delays are virtually eliminated. The vast majority of our handovers now happen within 30 minutes. It's work that's also being rolled out by another one of my colleagues in the Royal Sussex County area.
Thank you. That's particularly relevant, Dave. Thank you for your local leadership for that, but also that of your colleagues, that relationship with our fellow colleagues in hospital and AD departments is crucial to making this work, isn't it? So thank you.
I'll just pick up on your second piece around violence and aggression. I think it's fair to say, and everyone will see it reported across multiple different media outlets, etc. And if you talk to police colleagues as well, I think we're all experiencing a high level of overall... it's aggression. I think it's a frustration that people are living with now in our lives, with the fact that our lives have changed totally in the last couple of years. Are we still experiencing high levels? Yes, much higher than I would want. The fact that we are part of the trial into body-worn videos for ambulance services, that only started last year. It is being formally evaluated by universities, so it'll probably be another year before we see those results. But it is a good tool to have. Not everyone wants to use it. It's been voluntary from that point of view. But it's not just frontline crews who are experiencing it when they see patients face-to-face. Our call centre staff face abuse on a daily basis as well. And whilst we recognise, sometimes people can come across quite aggressive when they're panicking, when they're fearful, when they're very emotional, actually our staff are very good at being able to delineate out whether that's an emotional response or whether it's a bit more of a direct aggression piece. We do have a mechanism of reporting this, looking into it, investigating, working with the quality and nursing team to look at trends, just to see where there are hotspots and how we can do things. I'm sure if I was to reach out to Amjad and David Hyde, we're also working more closely with the police, because actually where there is violence and aggression, we really want to support our staff and our police colleagues to take this through a prosecution where it is appropriate to do so, because we need to be really clear. This is a work environment. We have a professional responsibility to our staff to make it as safe as it can be, which means we also need to hold our patients and the public to account for their behaviours when they interact with us. But I think there's a lot going on, but we are absolutely encouraging as much recording as possible where that does happen, whether it be a verbal or a physical incident of aggression.
Thank you. Any other questions from the floor? Mom, is there a question over here?
Hello, I'm Tessa Weaver. I'm a community first responder, have been for 16 years, so I've seen it all here. You've got a very exciting programme of change that you've been talking about, and I think that everybody's going to be welcoming that with open arms. But in the past, CCAM have struggled to implement change, certainly at speed, and most of us will have used the phrase CCAM treacle in the past to describe that process. Have you considered whether your decision-making processes are as up-to-date as the changes you plan to make in the future so that they can implement those changes at the speed you'd like them to start happening?
Yeah, thank you. Good question. Sean, do you want to have a quick initial go at that?
That's a great question. I think the two things I've heard consistently is that the tanker ship is difficult to turn, and the second one is how does it stick this time? And I think we've taken both of those into serious consideration. We've got quite a radically different programme structure underneath those four pillars, which is, I would describe, much more agile daily and weekly decision-making rather than the churn of we can only decide on something because it needs to go to a committee in a month's time. So it is the programme of delivery fit for purpose to make change quickly? I would say yes. The reality is we struggle to get enough people into that programme. So the infrastructure will enable us to, and now we're drawing upon system partners in NHS England to say, can you please give us some more find it difficult to make rapid decisions and hold corporate governance responsibility in equal balance. The one thing I would say about that is we all managed it for 2 years in the pandemic. And I was at an event in London with people from around the country on Wednesday, and I think the national team at NHS England are reflecting that somehow at the moment we need to foster that energy and pace in decision making that we were forced into 2.5 years ago. So not to throw us backwards into the COVID mentality, but something about agile decision making, shared risk, shared workforce models, doing things differently, I think is where we need to be. So I can't comment on the past, but I can say that there's been due consideration from David and his team about a fit for purpose change programme that allows us to pivot, make decisions. And I think my reflection on the title of the fourth pillar is a good example of that. David sent me an email and said, can we add the word partnership in? And I said, yes. You know, we didn't. Now, someone somewhere might say, well, that should have gone through a committee and a structure and a meeting, but it doesn't need to. You know, we need to decide what the priorities are and then hold the mirror up about how we're delivering. So I think it's a good question, and I think we're in as good a position as we could be about the balance of governance, oversight, assurance and agility to deliver.
I think it's a great question. I'll bring in some of the other members of the panel to get perhaps a different perspective from their how they view it. Subo, as a non-executive independent director, have you got a view in terms of how are we going to make sure the real question here, what's promised is delivered?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think from my perspective, some of this is around supporting local decision-making. So on some of the visits that I've done around the patch and visiting some of the MRCs and talking to people on the ground, visiting the Royal Sussex A&E department where some of our crews have been waiting and discharging patients, a lot of the things that they say to us are that they would like to have more autonomy locally. And I think that's something that we can support through this change programme, perhaps help them to make decisions more quickly. Knowing what the local needs are and also how they can use their workforce locally to best effect, knowing what their skill sets are and what their local patient populations are as well. So that's another area perhaps that where we can support them.
Yeah, thank you. Lee, we've had quite a deep discussion at the Council of Governors this morning on the improvement plan. The Council of Governors has got a role as well, obviously holding me and the non-executives to account. Do you have a perspective on this to make sure, again, what's promised is delivered?
Well, thanks, Tessa, for the question, because I think it is very valid talking to the community resilience management. I know they do come across situations where they're all working on issues for, well, not issues, but changes they would like to make for a very long time. Putting papers together that may disappear in the system. I think the improvement programme that is in place now and will continually develop, I think will make a massive change to this. And I'm confident in what Siobhan's saying, that the processes to make decisions, whether, as Sue said, they may be locally or need to be at sort of trust level, I'm confident that they will speed up in future. As Luke mentioned, it had to happen during the pandemic, so I would expect that we can introduce some of those methods for quick decision making going forward.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, perhaps just to finish off on that particular point, on behalf of the board, I think the treacles. We're all engaged in this, and I think what we want is two-way communication here. And I think now we've been let out. Now the fact we're no longer in lockdown and we are beginning to communicate face to face, not on Teams, we've got an opportunity. I think the signal I'm giving from the board, I think with Subo has given, well, ask the question. You know, if things aren't happening, well, go through the appropriate. There's a way of raising things, and I would ask that, you know, with appropriate line management, if they don't respond, well, then it goes higher. What I want to try and ensure is that CCAM sorts its own troubles out. What's begun to happen is we've ended up going out to external bodies and others in order for this voice to be heard. And I, you know, the challenge we're putting down from the board to everyone, it's all of our problem, is let's make sure we sort it out ourselves, because it's our organisation, not the CQC's, and we've got to sort this, because quite frankly, if we don't get people working collectively together in the organisation, feeling we're all being pulling in the same direction, we're not going to give the best care to our patients. So we've got to get it right. It's important. So you've struck a really important point in terms of the question you ask. I've heard about the Seacam treacle, and it's about time we put the lid on it and got rid of it, quite frankly. Right, other comments from the questions, please, before we conclude. Mom?
Thank you. My name is Rosemary Moore. I'm from the other part of Surrey. I've had recent experience of being admitted in emergency in the St Peter's Hospital, Chertsey. I've had lots of dealings through relatives in the Royal Surrey Hospital and the last mental NHS hospital left in Surrey, Farnham Road Hospital. My question is about the ambulances and the private ambulances. I'd like to know how the contract works with Seacam's contract for having private ambulances and when it is decided they should be used. And also, what is the difference between the contract that Seacam has with various, I think there are three or four of them, private ambulance companies, and what the individual hospital's contract is, which I think is different. They can bring in private ambulances if they wish, and I think that means that the funding would come from the hospital funding and the Seacams, but I suppose it's all basically through CCGs. But that's my question.
Thank you. Emma?
Thank you. So the way it works for us, the Seacam, is yes, we get funded through the ICSs now. What were the CCGs? They paid us to deliver the 999 service. We have agreed that a small proportion we would use and we would use private ambulance services for. That allows us to create a bit more surge. It allows us to flex those resources a bit more. And working with David's team, when we look ahead, we're very clear about when we want to use them, how we want to use them. Also recognising not every operating unit will have private ambulance provision. It's very much where we need them. And we review it on a regular basis. They operate exactly the same as our 999 crews, so they're dispatched the same, they have the same clinical expectations of delivery. We have the quality nursing team taking through a whole process from a governance point of view. They're all CQC registered, so they operate, in essence, exactly the same way as we do. They are a supplement within our service. With relation to the second part of your question, I think each hospital will commission their own. That isn't through the CCGs, that will be through their own budgets, the same way as we pay our private providers, but it will depend very much on what they want their ambulances to do. So that probably will depend on those hospitals and the services they provide. But I can't comment on the skill level and how they function. That would be a contractual mechanism through the hospitals and how they use them. But our ones are in essence, operate the same as our frontline crews.
Thank you. Any other questions, please? Before we conclude, Brian.
Thank you. Brian Chester, I'm a publicly elected governor for Upper West, which actually covers Surrey and Northamptonshire. It just something occurred to me listening to both from the Council of Governors meeting this morning and what I've heard today. Actual fact, nothing has been raised about the impact of the ICS integrated care system, which came into effect, if you like, legally on the 1st of July. When we look at our ability and enhancing our ability to work with partners, do we see that? It's probably a question for Siobhan and possibly for Philip. Is that going to enhance our ability to move swiftly, or is it actually, might it hinder us?
So, for an organisation such as Seacam, I think the development of the ICS is a really good thing because units of planning and strategy, decision making, and funding that are at a county level of Surrey, notwithstanding it's slightly more complex with Surrey, but Kent and Sussex, will help to make strategic and investment decisions in a more, yes, I think, speedy way and in a more coherent way. The reason we probably haven't talked about it is we're in this odd health and social care policy context, which is the year had already started with CCGs being contractually obliged to deliver the kind of, closing contract investment decisions. ICBs, ICSs, so integrated care boards have been established as new businesses, so they've got their hardwiring, their infrastructure, their people to recruit. So are we realising the benefit now? I would say no, we're in a transition period, but will it create more synergy, easier conversations, an ability to plan for the future in a more coherent way for populations that we serve? Yes, absolutely. Just on a simple level, I've been bringing the three ICB chief execs together once a month to have CCAM conversations. Even just that, so having Kent Surrey and Sussex chief execs talking to the chief exec of CCAM, I understand is progress from what the past used to look like. So I'm fairly hopeful that it will be good. It will just take time, I think, for the ICSs and the ICBs to embed their new structures. And I think there will come a time where, both at board and council of government level, we should be talking to you about the impact of that and the opportunities. I just think we're probably not there yet, another couple of months, and it will start to become a bit more clear. The last thing I'd say is it will only be a number of months down the road, and we'll be planning for next year in terms of, you know, priority, strategy, ambition, investment. So I think over the next few months we'll probably get some discussions on the forward agendas for both council of governors and board.
Thank you. Phil, is there anything you want to add on a financial planning point of view?
Yeah, I think it's too early to see any significant change from just moving from an integrated care system to integrated care boards, because from our perspective, I think from a contracting and finance point of view, there's not any significant overnight change. Effectively, we have still our, we are aligned to the Surrey Heartlands Integrated Care Board, and we report all of our financial numbers through them. They act as our lead commissioner. It's not an ideal scenario, because obviously our contracting for our services across the whole of Kent, Surrey, Sussex, and Bluff, Hampshire. So you can't sort of ignore that there are other ICBs, two other main ICBs, that are also involved in terms of funding. So I think we need to see how this sort of develops, I think, in terms of, you know, how it's going to affect a service that spans across numerous ICBs, and how that pans out in the future, whether the sort of the hosting arrangements are maintained as they currently are, or whether that will change. So
And in the spirit of partnership working, actually, I'm very, very pleased to say Ian Smith, who's the chairman of the Surrey Integrated Care Board and our lead commissioner, actually has been attending this meeting and listening intently on the back row there. So, Ian, there's anything you wanted to say about that, our developing relationship?
Indeed. So I think it's a great question. Frankly, the success of the ICS will be the extent to which we do respond to that. I think I went out on an ambulance 2 weeks ago for a 12-hour shift, and it's quite clear to me there's an awful lot in the community, in the primary networking with GPs, for instance, that we really can help CCAM and ambulance services generally, and take a lot of the pressure off of them, particularly for C3 and C4 patients. So hold us to account for that, because frankly these changes to an integrated care system would have been an expensive reorganization if we cannot deliver improved performance and support for organizations like CCAM. In terms of the lead commissioner, you know, we are the lead commissioner, but you know, we're very conscious of the Sussex and Kent aspects to this. So again, hold us to account if you feel we're being too Surrey focused. As Siobhan says, the chief executives of the three ICBs are now meeting regularly, and you know, we are going to make this work and make a difference.
Thank you. And just a comment, I've been around long enough to see several versions of NHS organisations, and it's fair to say that the previous 20 years have actually been dividing the NHS into separate sovereign organisations where it was very difficult collectively to work together. We've got an opportunity with this new structure to work collectively in a way that, as Ian is saying, is an integrated care board across the 3.5 counties that we serve. On a personal level, I deal regularly with chairs now of the ICBs. And as well as the proof is, you know, we've had a quite a tough time recently. Our executives have done a fantastic job in leading this organisation out of some quite dark times over the winter, partly caused by the pandemic and partly caused by issues of our own making. All I can say is, as part of the remedy to that, we've had significant support from the integrated care boards and from the wider NHS system in a way possibly might not have happened some years ago, when maybe we'd have got more into a blame culture. What we've got now is recognition that CCAM's challenges are as much a system challenge as they are the challenges of our organisation. It's a bit of both. So it's early days, but I'm confident we can make this work. So I think it now got to the end of the question and answer session. So what I'd like to do is first of all thank the panel for their responses. More importantly, thank the audience for asking the questions. And just to say, can I just thank everyone for turning up today and to playing an active part in the meeting, both either as one of the governors or as members of the public. And really on behalf of the board, I think, and the Council of Governors, just to give a heartfelt thanks not only to those who serve in office in CCAM, but more importantly to our staff who have been there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're serving the public of the South East in a very professional way, in spite of all the challenges. Whenever they're in front of a patient, their professionalism has been exemplary. And we've had I'm speaking that objectively based on patient feedback. So thank you for what you do. Thank you all for participating today. And I hope you found the openness of this meeting of benefit. Now, there's an opportunity. We've still got, so our professional colleagues are still around. There's still some of our vehicles available. So if you want a chance to network, please do so. But thank you for your attendance. Have a safe journey home.